He had given Maurice a large gold crucifix, and Maurice carried it with him now at all times, even slept with it clutched in his hand. It was a relief to Maurice to have a physical object that offered protection. Seeing the priest now, Maurice reached for the crucifix tucked in his belt. "I have my friend with me," he said, a little sheepishly. As he drew it out, the crucifix suddenly flew from his hand and went flying across the room, narrowly missing Father Beardsley's left eye. He cried out in surprise. It crashed into a glass case behind him, shattering it instantly. Father Beardsley recovered quickly and picked up the cross. Maurice was staring at his outstretched hand. Ed, Lorraine, and Father Beardsley looked at Maurice's palm in wonderment, seeing what looked like a burn mark where he had handled the cross. A remaining glass shard tinkled to the floor. Ed knew that it was essential that Maurice and the others be calm for the psychiatric evaluation. The demonologist didn't want the doctor walking in to find a distraught Maurice and immediately conclude that he was mentally unstable. So he did his best to put the conversation on a normal footing. After all, he pointed out, such an incident was the very reason the group was assembled today in the rectory. And in many ways, the cross flying out of Maurice's hand was the least of what they had seen in recent weeks. 20 minutes later, the doctor arrived. He looked exactly as Maurice had imagined, tall, sturdy, square-jawed, with piercing gray eyes and glasses. It was more than his classic Germanic features, though, that bothered Maurice. With just one glance, he could tell that this man was without compassion. He exuded no warmth at all. On the contrary, he had a disturbing coldness about him. Maurice just figured that came with the territory, though. After all, he's a headcracker, he thought. The doctor introduced himself, shook hands all around, and quickly closeted himself with Maurice in Father Beardsley's private office. The group waited in silence. After a short time, the psychiatrist opened the door. "Ed, would you join us, please?" he asked. When the three men were alone, the psychiatrist began to question Ed closely regarding Maurice and his friendship with him. How did Ed feel about Maurice? What was his interest in Maurice's case? How did the two men get along? And on and on. The doctor seemed intent on proving that Maurice was in some way sexually deviant. Finally, Ed impatiently interrupted. "Look," he said, his face reddening. "We came here to help because of the things that have been happening in Maurice's home." "Well," replied the doctor, "I'm afraid I don't believe in any of that stuff." "Would you call yourself a Catholic?" said Ed. "I'm not here to discuss my personal beliefs with you." "Hey now, wait a minute. Don't you even believe in God?" A little religious indignation was rising up in Ed. "There you go, asking questions," the psychiatrist interrupted, speaking in a condescending tone of voice. Pointing his finger, Ed said, "You say you want to ask us questions. Then I'm going to ask you questions. You say when you're dead, you're dead. What about Christ, if you're such a good Catholic? The Bible says on the third day he rose."
"I simply don't want to talk about that stuff."
"The reason we wanted to see you was to get help," Ed snapped. He rose to leave, and Maurice, seeing his friend get up, followed suit. Beet red, Ed stormed out and grabbed Lorraine's hand in front of the astonished eyes of Father Beardsley.
"Come on, honey, we're leaving," Ed said firmly. "Father Beardsley, we'll call you."
The Theriols certainly hadn't expected this to happen, and their heads were spinning from the sudden drama. They all piled into the car and drove off quickly, gravel flying out behind the tires. But as they were pulling onto the steep road that runs between St. Paul's Church and the rectory, Maurice cried out,
"Ah, my back, my back!"
He was moaning in pain.
"Maurice, honey, what is it?" Nancy asked.
Ed slammed on the brakes, ran around the car, and yanked open the back door.
"Help me get his shirt off, Nancy," he instructed.
As the pair struggled to peel off Maurice's plaid hunting shirt in the chilly March air, the car became silent. There, across Maurice's shoulder blades, was an enormous cross that looked as if it had been burned into his flesh. Ed grabbed Maurice by the hand and started down the driveway.
"What are you doing?"
Nancy sobbed as Ed led Maurice by the arm toward the rectory.
"We're going to show this doubting Thomas proof," Ed shouted over his shoulder.
As the twosome climbed the stairs to Father Beardsley's office, the now breathless Ed turned Maurice around in front of the priest. Father Beardsley's jaw dropped open. Ed called out to the psychiatrist.
"I think you'd better come have a look at this, doctor," he said.
The doctor was on the phone. When he hung up and emerged from Father Beardsley's office, Ed demanded,
"So what's your explanation for this?"
The doctor looked speculatively at Maurice's back.
"Okay, Maurice," he said. "How did you do this to yourself? I've been honest with you. Now you have to be honest with me."
Ed Warren felt the hair stand up on his head. He was so angry he was shaking. He knew this so-called scientific type had a completely closed mind, and there was no getting through. Ed's eyes narrowed. "Listen here, you," he said through clenched teeth. "I hope that when you're by yourself, something comes up and smashes you right in the mouth, as has happened to this poor man you refuse to help. If he needs a psychiatrist, it's not gonna be you." Turning to Father Beardsley, Ed fought to control himself.
"I'm sorry, Father, but we came here for help," Ed said. "Now we're leaving."
As Ed backed the car out of the driveway for the second time, Father Beardsley turned to the psychiatrist.
"You know, sir," he said, "I think you're a nasty man."
The priest was so upset that he left the rectory and went for a walk to calm himself. The case of Maurice Frenchy Theriault was now public property. The police report of the incident at the farmhouse, when Chief Siebert and Trooper Kearns responded to Nancy's frantic call for help after Maurice had cut himself in the bathroom, was picked up by a local newspaper. Like most news-gathering organizations, the paper had a police scanner operating 24 hours a day. The police blotter the next day carried some details of the stop Trooper Kearns had made. On Thursday, March 21st, the Springfield Morning Union carried a story by reporter Sandra E. Constantine with the headline, "Church Considers Performing Exorcism in Warren." The story quoted Father Beardsley as saying that an investigation was underway. Bishop Timothy Harrington was unavailable for comment. While the story did not identify Maurice Theriault by name, it did give the town where he lived. By the next day, the Boston Herald, a racy tabloid owned by Australian publisher Rupert Murdoch, had jumped on the story. "Are demons at work here?" screamed the Herald's banner headline. The story in the Herald also did not give Maurice's name. Although a Herald reporter was able to track him down, Maurice would not comment, and the paper's editors decided to withhold his name for the moment. The story reported that a team of demonologists had been called in to study the man identified only as a Warren man, and that the church was considering performing an exorcism. The next day, the Herald followed up with another story. "Farmer battling the devil," screamed the headline. A subhead added, "Exorcism is the only answer, psychic." The story by ace reporter Joe Shaka detailed the strange phenomena that had plagued Maurice, this time referred to not by name, but by occupation, a farmer. The story revealed that the farmer bled from the eyes and that objects flew about his home, defying the laws of nature. It also quoted Ed and Lorraine Warren as saying that the only way the man could be freed was through exorcism. And in this story, for the first time, the office of Bishop Timothy Harrington confirmed that the matter was officially under investigation by the church. In other words, this was no joke. By now, of course, the story of Maurice Theriault was the talk of the town of Warren. Many people in the small town had already heard something of what was going on in the farmhouse on Brimfield Road. After these stories came out, everybody knew about it. And Maurice's already magnified fear was increasing with each newspaper story. Only wishing to be free of his affliction, he had no idea that he would have to become the center of a media-fed frenzy. On Monday, the Herald followed up with a reaction from the townspeople of Warren. The headline, Satan Isn't in Our Town. The story, by reporter Timothy Clifford, quoted neighbors and Warren residents who doubted Maurice's story, although many expressed compassion. Most of the comments in the story simply revealed people's misconceptions about exorcism. From what I hear, said one woman, if a possessed person goes near a priest or holy water, he goes completely wild. The next day, another Herald reporter got Warren's police chief Siebert to comment for the first time about the case that had his little town making news in the big city of Boston. Police chief discloses demon case, was the headline in the Herald when Siebert broke his silence. The story quoted the chief as saying, he had evidently just come out of a seizure, but I didn't see any convulsions. Siebert did confirm seeing a cross or X on Maurice's back. Then Siebert said something that tantalized the reporter. There are some things about this case that I just can't talk about right now, he said. But if you treat me fair, I'll tell you everything when the time is right. And there are some things that I'll tell you that will make your hair stand on end. The reporter promised he wouldn't betray the chief's confidence, and continued to pursue the story from different angles. By the next week, the National Enquirer, the granddaddy of sensational tabloids, was onto the story in a big way. And so was the Weekly World News, another supermarket tabloid. Possessed man begs for exorcism, shouted the headline in the Weekly World News. Evil power tears his flesh and flings him through the air. The Weekly World News may have lost points with journalism professors on style, but they had the incredible facts right. Maurice was being tormented by a diabolical force. And with the sensational coverage in the press, he was also being tormented by mockers, thrill-seekers, and heartless neighbors who would drive up to the house, honk their horns, and scream, "Devil worshiper!" or, "The devil lives here!" Others would call the house at all hours to hiss, "Get out of town!" Church services at St. Paul's in Warren seemed to be composed half of curious onlookers and half of newspaper reporters. Maurice hardly dared show himself. It was too much for Father Beardsley. In the church's weekly bulletin on Palm Sunday, he lashed out at merciless and cruel reporters who call the rectory at all hours and had the gall to try to see the person involved, looking for sly comments from individuals in town completely unaware of any facts. From the pulpit that very day, the usually gentle priest also made the Maurice Theriault case the subject of his sermon. He accused the media of trying to make a weirdo and a freak of the poor farmer. Outside the church, Herald photographer Jim Mahoney focused his telephoto lens through a window and snapped a picture of the priest as he railed against the media. It was the type of sneak shot that the tabloid specialized in. The Herald ran the photo the next day, along with a story headlined, Church Weighing Exorcism. After Mass, Father Beardsley talked to Herald reporter Joe Heaney about Maurice. I know him, and he is a good church-going man who needs our compassion, the priest said. I don't know why people would want to go out and hurt him. This is not a freak show. But it was a cartoon that appeared in the Herald that proved particularly upsetting to Maurice and Nancy. It showed an old farm couple in the style of Grant Wood's American Gothic, standing in front of their house, with demons and ghosts crowding the background. Nice folks, says one police officer to another. Kids are ugly as sin, though. This was just too much. Maurice and Nancy were crazy about their grandchildren, and the cartoon hurt. After the cartoon had appeared, cartoonist Don Bailey received a strange phone call from someone purporting to be Maurice. The caller angrily warned him that he didn't know who he was messing with, and to expect disaster. Less than a week later, Bailey's father suffered a debilitating stroke. By the time Holy Week came around, the Maurice Theriault case had become Chief Siebert's nightmare as well. He had to go out to the farmhouse often to drive off the tourists and hecklers who'd been driving up and down Brimfield Road trying to spot the devil. All the publicity had suddenly made Warren a tourist destination. The chief saw this as the worst kind of publicity his town could receive, a negative that could be hard to undo. Siebert himself had been getting his share of attention from the media. That was another thing he didn't care for. After a couple of interviews, in which he gave only the barest threads of information, he decided to clam up. Besides, he had some more investigating to do. He'd go out to the house under the pretense of wanting to protect Frenchy from the hecklers. In fact, he might actually be needed for that purpose. It was Monday of Holy Week, the day after the Boston Herald had interviewed Father Beardsley at Palm Sunday Mass. The creeps usually came out in force after a newspaper story. When he got there, things were quiet. A couple of cars drove by and honked, but fortunately there was no trouble. Siebert spotted Frenchy out in the yard and drove up to him. "How's it going, Frenchy?" he asked. "Anybody giving you any trouble?" Frenchy figured Siebert was there to pry, as usual, and wanted to answer, "Nobody but you, Chief." But he held his tongue. Better to be friendly, he thought. "It's quiet today," he said. "But I never know when something's going to happen. The hecklers, I can handle them. It's this other thing that's got me licked." Siebert chuckled. "Still after you, huh?" Maurice glared at him. "You still don't believe, even after what you and that colored fella saw?" For all his cynicism and suspicion, Siebert had never actually closed his mind completely to what Maurice and Ed were saying. Sure, it was far-fetched and probably a crock, but there was that small part of his mind, the part that had been brought up Catholic, that was willing to at least entertain this stuff about demons and possession. "Let's just say I'm skeptical," Siebert replied. "Well, why don't you come over and spend the night one night this week?" Maurice asked. "You'll see." Siebert raised his eyebrows. "You want me to stay overnight?" "Sure," Maurice said. "I ain't got nothing to hide. You'll see. Then maybe you'll believe me." "Okay," Siebert said. "You got it. How's tomorrow night?" "Fine with me," Maurice said. So at 7 the next evening, Chief Siebert, armed with a camera and a bottle of holy water Father Beardsley had given him, came prepared to spend the night at the Theriault farmhouse. He kept the visit a secret from his wife, telling her only that he would be out all night on surveillance. No need to scare her unnecessarily. No reason to tell her he was planning to spend the night with the devil, he thought to himself with a little laugh. He rang the doorbell promptly at 7. But when Maurice opened it, he stared at Siebert as if he was the last person on earth he was expecting. "What do you want?" he asked. "Well, Frenchy, this is the night you invited me to stay over, and I'm here," said Siebert. Maurice started twitching. He had a certain look in his eye. Siebert noticed it right away. Maurice looked different, like someone else. "I don't think this is a good idea," Maurice said. "I don't think you should spend the night." "Now look, Frenchy, you invited me and I'm here. Why don't you let me see for myself and be convinced?" I don't think so," he said. "It's too dangerous. I better call the Warrens." Oh, Jesus, thought Siebert. "They'll put the kibosh on this for sure." Frenchy closed the door on Siebert and went off to call them. Sure enough, when he opened the door a few minutes later, he told Siebert that he couldn't stay the night. He explained that the Warrens had suggested another night, not during Holy Week. That would be better, since Holy Week is the worst time for psychic phenomena, and it could prove dangerous. But they said they would leave it up to Maurice and Siebert. "Well, I'm willing to take the risk," Siebert told Frenchy. But Frenchy insisted that he couldn't stay. "If you do, I'm going to sleep at a motel," he said. Siebert knew he couldn't force him, so he backed off. "Okay, Frenchy, have it your way. Maybe we'll do it another time." But he knew that Frenchy would never let him. The offer was another crock. As he pulled out of the driveway, Maurice peered out his living room window and watched the cruiser leave. His eyes began to tear blood, and his mouth began to drool yellow phlegm. his face contorted into a hideous shape, and he started breathing heavily.
"He-he-he," he muttered, more a growl than a laugh. "That bastard will never catch me. If he tries, I'll kill him."
Then he passed out, falling to the floor with a thud. He stayed there, sleeping, until Nancy came home about half an hour later with some groceries.
"What happened, honey?"
she said, dropping her bags to run to his side. Maurice came out of his deep sleep slowly. He shook himself awake.
"I don't know," he said. "I must have passed out. I was just going to answer the door for the chief. He was supposed to spend the night here tonight."
"So where is he?" Nancy asked.
"I don't know," Maurice replied. "I guess he changed his mind. Must have gotten scared off."
"Just as well," Nancy said. "I don't trust that guy. I think he's trying to get you, Maurice."
The next day, Maurice and Nancy received a visit from an old personal friend, Robert Manning. Robert was a landscape contractor and had been a guest of the Ferrialls on many occasions over the years. When the publicity storm broke, Robert wasted no time in getting to his friend's house. Unlike the neighborhood gawkers, he was there to offer comfort, not taunts.
"Why didn't you tell me you needed help?"
he said to Nancy as she took his jacket and led him into the kitchen, where Maurice was sitting. As he pulled out the yellow-flowered vinyl chair and sat down, he said, "I brought something from St. Joseph's in Canada, and I want you to have it." He pulled a vial of holy water out of his jacket pocket. "I got this specially for you, Maurice." Maurice had not even greeted his friend yet. He was just staring out the window. But Nancy, delighted with the gesture, took the bottle and proffered it to Maurice.
"Look, Frenchie, look what Robert brought from Canada."
"I don't want it," Maurice said, speaking in a monotone and still staring into space.
Nancy pushed the vial forward again.
"Come on, Frenchie, take it."
"No, I don't want it now," he repeated.
Nancy looked nonplussed.
"I'll put some on you then," she said, and with that, sprinkled some of the holy water on Maurice's forehead.
The instant the first drops hit his head, Maurice's body went stiff, and blood began to seep from his mouth. Then the holy water itself, running down Maurice's forehead, turned blood red. Before Nancy and Robert could react, Maurice rose, zombie-like, and went into the bathroom. The stunned Robert now had confirmation of what he had been reading in the newspapers. His face was white. Several minutes later, Maurice emerged from the bathroom and sat down at the table, as if he were entering the room for the first time that evening.
"Oh, hi, Robert," he said. "When did you get here?"
Robert was shaken but tried to stay cool and calm, mostly for Nancy's sake. He stayed at the Ferrial home for dinner, and there were no further incidents during the meal, though he kept looking at Maurice to make sure. When it came time for Robert to leave, there were warm words all around, and the Ferrial's friend assured them he would be there if they needed him. He was sure that Maurice's problem must be a physical one that was being misunderstood. Just as Robert reached the bottom of the Ferrial's driveway, he was hit by a tremendous rush of nausea, then by burning stomach pain, such as he had never before experienced or believed possible. His head was spinning and aching so badly that he thought it might explode. Immobilized by the pain, he stopped the car and prayed for it to pass. Everything had turned white before his eyes. A terribly foul smell was filling the car. After what might have been an hour, he managed to open a window. The cool air helped clear his head. He considered trying to drive back up the driveway to the Ferrial's house for help, but decided he'd try to drive home instead. He managed to navigate slowly out to the street, hanging on to the steering wheel, fighting the urge to black out again. He felt stronger and stronger as he got farther and farther from the house. When he finally reached home, he vomited all night.
"You're not going back to that house, no way," his wife said. "Whatever is in there didn't like you bringing that holy water. It's much too creepy for you to deal with, Robert.
Robert wasn't about to argue. He was scared to death. Later, Ed Warren explained it all to the Ferials. He was of the same opinion.
It's the fear factor, he said. Anytime you pose a threat to a demon, that is what it fears. And Robert definitely posed a threat because he came here to help you with something of a spiritual nature, the holy water.
Although Robert later agreed to appear before the bishop to testify to what he had seen, he never went to the Ferial home again. Maurice was an old friend, but Robert wasn't going to risk his life to help him. For Nancy, trying to sleep that night was difficult. Maurice lay oblivious with his face in the pillow, and she kept turning the day's events over and over in her mind. Then she heard a sound that bothered her. At first, she thought it was a dripping sound, perhaps from the bathroom. But the sound was eerie, and it wasn't coming from that area. Slowly, she realized that it seemed to come from the foot of the bed. She couldn't place what it was. Then it came to her. It sounded exactly as if a starving animal was gnawing a piece of raw meat, chomping and chewing, as she described it later. Frozen with fear, just as at the time the car had driven itself, she couldn't move or speak. So she feigned sleep and waited for the sounds to cease. She felt the hairs on her arms stand up, as the eating sounds were followed by animal-like howls. There would be no sleep for Nancy Ferial. Not that night. Not any time soon. Ed Warren knew that the strange incidents were bound to intensify around this time of year. It was the Lenten season, a time when psychic activity usually increases. That's why he was pushing so hard for a quick exorcism. He told a Boston Herald reporter that week that church officials were doing their best to get things underway. This is Holy Week, the time when these cases seem to explode. Ed promised that the exorcism would be over by Good Friday at the latest. But Good Friday came and went without an exorcism. So did Easter Sunday. So when Maurice and Nancy received a call from Father Beardsley 2 days after Easter, they were wary at first. He asked them to visit him in the rectory that afternoon. Maurice was convinced the church had ordered another psychiatric evaluation, and he'd had his fill of doctors who were unwilling to believe in the torments he was suffering. The farmer would dearly have loved exchanging places for just a day with one of these learned men to see what his attitude would be afterward. He was fed up with the whole approach, but knew there was no other plan. It was with much reluctance that Maurice and Nancy agreed to go to the rectory again with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Ed asked Maurice's friend Robert Manning to come with them to recount his experience. When the group arrived, they were surprised to see another Catholic priest with Father Beardsley. And they were even more surprised to hear him introduced as Bishop Timothy Harrington. While Ed and Lorraine had talked with the bishop on the phone several times, they had never met him in person. Bishop Harrington had a certain calm way about him, and Maurice felt comfortable with him. He could tell instantly that the bishop was a man of compassion and kindness. After Father Beardsley's many calls and the publicity about the case, the bishop had decided to meet Maurice himself. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary about the meeting, as the group sat and made conversation about, of all things, buying snow tires. Suddenly, the bishop seemed to make up his mind.
"Maurice, I'm going to say a prayer for you," he announced.
He asked Maurice to stand, and Ed Warren and Robert Manning stood on either side of the tormented farmer. Ed was gravely concerned that this spontaneous exorcism could go horribly awry.
"The bishop didn't know it, but he was in grave danger," he said later to Lorraine. "Maurice could have knocked his block off."
Putting his hand on Maurice's head, the bishop began saying a prayer to Saint Michael. Nancy, staring up at him, silently mouthed the words of the prayer in unison.
"Saint Michael, the archangel, defend us in battle. Be
our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil.
As the prayer began, Maurice's face began to change. His forehead swelled, and his eyes took on a sadistic gleam. He began to mutter in a deep, guttural voice that was no longer his own.
I am in the depths of this man's soul,
the creature inside Maurice growled and sputtered.
And I will have it.
Bishop Harrington continued to pray, while the creature bellowed,
You cannot destroy me! You cannot make me leave!
Bishop Harrington flinched, but continued to pray.
May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the heavenly host, by the divine power of God, cast into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander now throughout the world, seeking the ruin of souls.
Suddenly Maurice pitched forward onto his knees. The bishop took a bottle of holy water out of his cassock and began to sprinkle it furiously on Maurice, so liberally that when Maurice came to some minutes later, he was ashamed to think he had wet his pants. The bishop kneeled and placed his hand on Maurice's shoulder, looking at him straight on.
You are my brother, and I want to help you.
Maurice shook his head groggily and asked for a cigarette. The bishop, obviously shaken too, joined Maurice in a smoke.
I hope my prayers will help, he said.
I hope so too, Bishop, said Nancy. Thank you so much.
Lorraine, terribly moved by what she had seen, also spoke words of praise.
I have never seen anyone of your position, totally unprepared, attempt a thing like that, she said.
Although Ed did not want to discourage Maurice and his wife, he had his doubts. Cases of genuine possession call for a formal exorcism, he knew, not a few prayers, however well-intentioned. Maurice and Nancy seemed so cheerful on leaving the rectory that Ed suggested lunch, and the two couples were soon seated around a table at a local restaurant. Maurice, who had seemed very tranquil on the ride down, sat silent through most of the meal as the others chatted of inconsequential matters.
The bishop's such a nice man, Maurice gushed at one point. He's just like a regular Joe.
Suddenly he leaned forward and hissed at Ed.
I'd like to spit in both your faces.
His voice had completely changed. No one said anything. Ed and Lorraine looked at each other knowingly. It wasn't over yet. 11. Although Ed and Lorraine were hopeful that Bishop Harrington's spontaneous exorcism might calm Maurice and slow the pace of the possession, it was clear from his behavior in the restaurant immediately afterward that the prayers the bishop had said were not going to be enough. For the next 3 days at the end of March 1985, things were calm in the Theriault household. A group of trained observers and students from the Warren's New England School of Demonology were often at the house, either in pairs or larger numbers. The group included Assembly of God minister Jack Berman, police officer Kent Birch, Ryan Dufresne, Joey Taylor, seminarian Fred Salvio, college students Chris McKenna and Chris Finberg, Matthew Chase, handyman Benjamin Massey, Sonny Berryhill, and Jessica Spellman. Some had never before witnessed preternatural phenomena. Others had worked with the Warrens for years. All were trained observers. It was the two Chrises, Chris Finberg and Chris McKenna, who were in the house the night it became evident that the forces tearing at Maurice had certainly not been banished from his life as yet. Lorraine Warren took the phone call late that night, as a snoring Ed slept soundly beside her. Chris Finberg was on the phone. In the background, Lorraine could hear Nancy screaming,
Oh my God! Oh my God! Stop these things from flying around!
Finberg said that Maurice had been lying quietly on the bed with his granddaughter, when the two young men heard crashing sounds and Nancy starting to scream. Racing for a camera, then to his room, they found a hysterical Nancy, who managed to choke out that objects were flying about the room and smashing into the walls.
shards of shattered vases and pictures lay scattered about the room. Lorraine told the two young men to try to calm the Therials and themselves, but to get out of the house if anything further happened. She promised that she and Ed would be over in the morning. "Above all, someone must remain awake at all times," she counseled. Ed and Lorraine had wanted to spend more time at the Therial house, but they were distracted by another case, a haunted house, in the town of Tewksbury, Massachusetts, about 2 hours from Warren, in the Bay State's Merrimack Valley, north and west of Boston. That case, involving a classic poltergeist, was demanding more and more of their time, as another family, a mother and her young children, was being scared out of its wits by unexplained knockings, noises, and flying objects that had smashed nearly every mirror, window, and other breakable object in the home. The case had forced Ed and Lorraine to split their time in Massachusetts between Warren and Tewksbury, and caused them to send some of their researchers to Tewksbury to stay up all night in the possessed house to observe the strange phenomena there. As bad as things were in Tewksbury, Ed realized that Maurice needed most of his attention. He continued to spend the bulk of his time with the poor farmer. The day after the things had gone flying around the room at the Therial farm, Nancy sent all the children to stay with friends and relatives. Whatever was torturing Maurice, it was a force far more powerful than anything she could imagine. Far more powerful and far more evil. The children could not be around until this thing was finished, one way or another. Despite Lorraine's advice, there was little danger of anyone's going to sleep, not with the increasingly nightmarish events that had become commonplace around Maurice. Although the occurrences were terrifying for everyone, perhaps the most scared was Maurice himself. The following morning, Maurice was getting ready to shave. He filled up the old porcelain sink with hot water and wiped the steam off the mirror. As he looked, he was aghast to see not one, but two images of himself. It was the doppelganger again. So many times in his life, he had been told that he was in two places at once, but seeing it himself was something else again. He'd always thought that people were just mixed up. Maurice shook so hard he didn't dare hold a razor near his neck. He simply put the shaving utensil down and wiped the shaving cream off his face. He'd do without a shave that day. Even in the face of the demonic infestation, life on the farm had to go on as usual, and work had to go forward. Even the horrifying events of that month didn't mean that anyone would give the hard-working couple groceries or any other of life's necessities for free. On the contrary, people who used to extend credit now demanded cash. Most people assumed that Frenchie had gone crazy, and crazy people are not considered good credit risks. So the days immediately following Bishop Harrington's impromptu prayer service for Maurice found the farmer and his wife working hard in the greenhouse, preparing the fields for spring planting, and refurbishing the vegetable stand for the summer trade that would follow. One bright morning, Nancy was working with the small pots of tomato shoots in the greenhouse. On the other side of the long building, she heard her husband pounding a nail into a board. Bang! 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 "Frenchie, you want me to help you?" she called. No answer. "Frenchie?" Nancy crossed the greenhouse to where she'd heard the banging sounds. The greenhouse was empty. There was no one there. And there was no sign that anyone had been there. No hammer, no nails. Just a pile of 2x4s stacked in the corner where they had always been. "Oh, God, not another thing," Nancy thought. Stepping outside into the crisp March air, she called for Maurice again. "Frenchie!" As she stood there frantically scanning the fields, Maurice's truck rolled up the gravel driveway with a crunch of pebbles. She turned around, and out of the driver's side popped Maurice, looking as if he'd just come back from a pleasant drive around the block.
"Maurice, where were you?"
Nancy said, her face drained of color. "Down at the stand," he replied.
"Well, I was working in the greenhouse, and I kept hearing this banging,
and I was sure it was you.
Oh, that son of a bitch again, eh? Maurice said. I'll show him.
Maurice had forgotten that one of the strictest admonitions the Warrens had given him was to avoid challenging the evil force that was tormenting him. He raced into the greenhouse with Nancy right behind him, clutching his arm.
No, Frenchie, no! She cried.
But Maurice broke loose and stood defiantly in the middle of the greenhouse.
Come and get me now!
He shouted at the top of his lungs.
At that moment, as a horrified Nancy looked on, one of the 2x4s flew as if it had been hurled 50 feet across the greenhouse and smashed Maurice square in the head, knocking him to the floor. Screaming, Nancy managed to grab her husband by the collar and drag his dazed form out into the light snow that still covered the path to the house. The crisp March air seemed to revive Maurice. He had a nasty bump on his head, and blood was seeping from a minor cut on his scalp. But miraculously, he seemed otherwise unhurt. Saturday morning, Ed Warren couldn't sleep. He couldn't stay beside Maurice and Nancy every minute, yet he knew events were escalating and that a final reckoning was still in the future. The best he could do was to make sure a team of researchers was at the house every night and that he and Lorraine visited almost every day. On impulse, Ed decided to drive up to Warren right away. Skipping breakfast, Ed covered the 120-mile distance between Monroe and Warren in record time. Something was telling him the situation was urgent. When he pulled into the Ferryall driveway, the first thing he saw was Maurice sitting silent and immobile in his running truck. Ed recognized the unnatural stillness about Maurice and approached the car slowly. Peering in the window, he saw that the farmer had tears streaming down his face. He tapped lightly on the glass.
"Maurice, what is it?" he said.
Maurice looked piteously at his friend, his eyes brimmed with tears.
"Last night I wanted to hang myself," he said.
Ed knew that one of the signs of possession is the demon's desire to kill the body created by God in his image.
"I was too scared last night," Maurice said.
"But then I was going to do it this morning.
Just now I was going to do it.
I would have if you hadn't driven up."
Ed could see a piece of thick rope beside Maurice on the front seat.
"You're going to come out of this all right, Maurice," he said compassionately. "The church will save you."
"They already tried and nothing happened," Maurice shouted. "You've got to stop this thing."
"I promise you, we won't leave you alone," said Ed. "I promise you, help is forthcoming."
Ed's promise seemed to calm Maurice, and Ed led him back to the house, vowing to himself that he would redouble surveillance on Maurice by his trained observers. Sunday, Maurice followed Ed's advice and went to Mass at St. Paul's in downtown Warren. Sitting in the pew with Nancy, as they listened to Father Beardsley intone the Mass, Maurice suddenly heard his name called out in a deep and powerful voice.
"Maurice."
And again.
"Maurice."
Looking around to see who might play such a malicious trick, Maurice saw nothing but the congregation sitting silently with heads bowed. It was clear that no one but him had heard the voice. Chris Finberg kept notes on that night's events, notes that give some idea of the atmosphere inside the Ferryall farmhouse during that terrifying period. 10:30 p.m. Maurice's body aches all over. Every muscle in his body hurts. There is a smell of dog mess in the house. The room is so cold, and then it is so hot that you feel sick to your stomach. Maurice's son-in-law, Rick, said that each time the family comes to the farm, something happens. The family experiences tremendous pains in their bodies, unnatural pains. The researchers are also complaining of severe toothaches or pains in their bodies. As for Nancy, she didn't know what to do. Part of her wanted to leave this whole thing behind,
to be with her children or just leave the state, maybe go stay with her father. But she knew in her heart that she had to tough it out with her husband and listen to what the Warrens told her to do. She did have faith in God and believed that there had to be a good outcome. The Warrens had given her several prayers to say, and she said them constantly as she walked around the house. Before she'd sent the children from the house, she'd said prayers over them as well to keep them safe. On one occasion, after having experienced a good night's sleep for the first time in many weeks, both Maurice and Nancy woke up to find rosary beads clutched tightly in their hands. Neither had any idea how they'd gotten there. Nancy was seized by an overpowering conviction that the Lord was trying to protect her and Maurice. After the incident at the greenhouse, Maurice and Nancy were reluctant to venture out there again, but there was no getting around the amount of work that had to be done. Because of the cold weather, the greenhouse windows were blacked out and wrapped in plastic, giving the structure a solitary and menacing atmosphere. The next morning, an apprehensive Maurice went down to the greenhouse to work, while Nancy busied herself with household tasks. The normal, everyday nature of sweeping the floors, making the bed, and starting the laundry was reassuring. Whistling to herself as she did the dishes, Nancy could almost imagine that she was just like all the other housewives, caring for their families, and that her house was no different from theirs. She remembered when she used to be bored and frustrated by having to do the housework, and shook her head. Housework seemed like a pleasure now, she thought. Lost in her thoughts, Nancy failed to notice how long Maurice had been gone. It was almost lunchtime, but he hadn't even come back up to the house for a cup of coffee. Suddenly, she became worried. Hoping for the best, Nancy ran down to the greenhouse. The door jamb that Maurice had placed to keep the greenhouse door from flapping open was still in place, indicating that Maurice must be elsewhere. But Nancy was seized by a premonition that he was in there. "Frenchie!" she called. No answer. Removing the door jamb, Nancy entered the gloomy greenhouse. Maurice was standing in the middle of a long row of sawhorses, with a paper cup in his hand. "Oh, honey, you are in here!" exclaimed Nancy. Maurice didn't reply, but bent over suddenly and straightened up. His face was twisted into a sadistic leer. His brow became distended, ape-like. His eyes were infernal. The greenhouse was filled with that terrible odor. Nancy gasped. Whatever was staring at her was definitely not her husband. Instinctively, she reached for the cross she now carried at all times and brandished it in front of her. "I command you to leave in the name of Jesus Christ!" she cried. At the sound of the words, "Jesus Christ," Maurice grabbed his head and screamed in pure agony. "Argh!" His head drew back and he opened his mouth, which to Nancy's horror did not form a circle as anyone's mouth would have, but made the form of a square. Blood gushed forward out of this bizarre opening, spraying the floor of the greenhouse and splattering the sawhorses. Maurice collapsed in a heap, shaking as if he had malaria. Whatever had taken hold of him had let go. But not for long. If others, including the police, now seemed to shun the Theriault family, their relatives continued to visit and to lend emotional support. They came despite the fear that invariably gripped visitors as soon as they approached the house. A house that, in addition to Maurice, Nancy, and the Warrens' team of investigators, now seemed to harbor an evil presence. All who entered felt it. None of them would have come again were it not for family loyalty. The night after the second greenhouse incident, Maurice's daughter Nicole, her husband Rick, and Maurice's three grandchildren had stopped by to help create a family atmosphere they felt might help distract Maurice. Worried about the children, Nancy tried to dissuade them from coming, but they insisted on showing their support. Maurice's sister Anne had called and was also going to drop in.
four of the researchers working with the Warrens were staying at the house with Maurice and Nancy.
I hope there's safety in numbers, thought Nancy.
Anne drove up the familiar driveway, parked, and got out of her light blue Volkswagen Bug. As she approached the farmhouse, she thought she saw a large black form emerging from the shadows around the side of the house. Anne laughed nervously.
"Okay, Maurice, don't try to scare me," she said,
pulling her hat down over her ears. But the form was not Maurice, and as it swept over her, Anne felt spasms of fear and nausea. She paused in the driveway for a moment, then sat on the steps until she had collected herself. The family was gathered around the kitchen table, unaware that Anne was outside. Inside the living room, at that same moment, the four researchers scrambled to start a tape recorder to capture loud knocking and rapping noises that were reverberating throughout the house. As soon as Anne entered the house, however, the noises stopped. Later that evening, as they sat around the table, the children chattered gaily about their friends and their latest activities. But Maurice was silent and morose. Picking up little Julia, his granddaughter, he seemed to gaze into the distance.
"I'll be glad when this son of a bitch leaves, so I can play with you," he said.
As the words came out of his mouth, Maurice's body was rocked backward as if he had been dealt a mammoth blow. The farmer landed on his back with a thud, with little Julia still cradled in his arms, screaming in fright. When Ed Warren heard the story, he had little doubt as to who the son of a bitch was. Joey Taylor was one of the researchers who often spent the night with the Theriols during this time. A Bridgeport, Connecticut resident who taught elementary school, Joey had been fascinated by the work of the Warrens and eagerly participated whenever they asked for help. He now found himself seated at the Theriol kitchen table with Maurice and Nancy, as well as another researcher, Sonny Berryhill. The slender Joey, who weighed just 145 pounds and stood 5 feet 5 inches, was only too glad to have Sonny with him. Sonny's hobby was weightlifting, and he looked it. If anything was to go wrong, Joey would just as soon have someone around who was capable of restraining Maurice. Joey had never been this close to a preternatural experience, and he was very excited. Ed and Lorraine had given the young men strict instructions to observe, to take notes, and not to share what they wrote with one another or with the Theriols. But Joey couldn't resist a little experiment. He had brought a bottle of holy water with him, and he wanted to see if what Ed had taught him in class about a possessed person's reaction to holy water was true. The short little farmer sitting before him certainly didn't seem possessed. "Hey, Maurice, let's see what happens when you drink this," he said, offering the vial of holy water. Maurice looked at him hard for a long moment. Joey felt a chill go down his spine. Nancy started to speak, but stopped when Maurice's countenance completely changed. With a grin, he obligingly took a sip. In 15 seconds, he went stiff, his eyes rolled back, he clenched his fist, and started to tremble. In front of his stunned observers, his jaw sagged open, and he let out a mouthful of blood onto the yellow placemat before him. Scared and amazed, the two men had enough presence of mind to grab their cameras and take photographs of the scene. Moments later, Maurice revived. He looked tired and bewildered.
"Maurice, do you remember anything that happened here just now?" Joey asked.
Maurice shook his head dumbly.
"You don't remember the holy water? Nothing?"
Maurice shook his head again. He seemed exhausted. Nancy was wiping up the pool of blood and spittle from the placemat. Joey looked at Sonny. He was white.
"No more experiments tonight," Joey said.
Maurice decided he wanted to visit his father's grave. Thinking that his torment was in some way connected to his father and the cruel experiences of his youth, Maurice believed that if he finally made peace with the old tyrant, even forgave him for the murder of his mother, he might gain a small measure of peace himself. Ed was doubtful, but didn't want to discourage Maurice, especially in his fragile emotional state. "Go ahead and go," he said. "But take some holy water and take a camera. If something happens, I want it documented. That will make it easier for the church to believe us and to help you." So Maurice and Nancy, equipped with a vial of holy water and a Polaroid camera, set off for Holyoke, Massachusetts, the last resting place of Maurice's brutal father and the woman he had victimized all her life, even to her final moments. The day was fine and clear, and a temporary warming trend gave a small foretaste of the spring to come. Maurice had rolled down the driver's side window on the pickup truck and was enjoying the snap of the crisp air as it rushed by his ears. Nancy was listening to country music on the radio and humming along. Maurice's eyes began to tear as he thought of the ordinary life he would like to lead, like other people. Looking compassionately at her husband, Nancy spoke what was on his mind. "We should be going to a nice restaurant or for a walk in the woods, instead of something like this," she said. Maurice could only nod his head. On such a beautiful day, it was not difficult to find their errand bizarre. But for Maurice, the day and all its beauty were an illusion. Reality was something darker. Something unspeakable. They arrived at the cemetery about 2:30 in the afternoon and drove directly to the Theriault tombstone. Maurice, dressed in a red hunting cap and red plaid jacket, parked the truck on one of the cemetery's small winding roads and sat with the door open, staring across a small green expanse at the block of granite bearing the word Theriault. The dates of birth and the identical dates of death of his mother and father were inscribed underneath. Maurice's breath showed white in front of his face, despite the relatively pleasant weather, as he sat there in the driver's seat of the truck, trying to muster the courage to cross the 30 yards between him and his father. It might have been 4 years since Philip had died, but as far as Maurice was concerned, he was still alive. The terror in his own early life had always been authored by the brutal figure of his father, and the farmer was sure that the torment that was haunting him now was, in some way, connected to the cruel old man who lay buried here. "Well, Frenchie, are you going to go over there?" Nancy asked. "Yeah, I'm going," he replied, and got out of the truck. Shedding his jacket and hat, he approached the grave dressed in a t-shirt and jeans. Nancy followed with the camera. When he arrived at the grave that contained all he had loved and feared as a child, Maurice dropped to his knees in front of the tombstone and began to pray. Nancy stood